I wanted to say that I'm really glad to be here, and this is the first time I've talked about this book at all since it hasn't even been published yet. And I was really pleased to do it here. First of all, this is Frank Gehry's alma mater, USC. And secondly, to be able to do it in front of a group of friends is really quite wonderful. So, and you've all been hearing about this book a lot for some years now. And as you know, it started about 4 years ago, or as you may not know, and it was one Sunday in December 2004, I was at Disney Hall, and Frank Gehry was at Disney Hall, and we were chatting, and he said, I have this interesting project I want to talk to you about, so I should give me a call. So, of course, I called the next day, and then I went to see him the following week. And the project was that he was then 75 years old. He's going to be 80 years old next month. And he had been thinking about the future. And I had been interviewing him at that point since the 80s for newspapers, magazines, and books. And he trusted me. He was interested in working on an oral history. Now, I was very interested in working on an oral history with him. And what began that way soon developed into Conversations with Frank Gehry, the book that Knopf is publishing in April, and then I'm talking about here today. Here's the bound galley. That's all the authors in the room. It's the most exciting moment when that book is bound galley arrives. Anyway, at his Los Angeles office and Santa Monica home, over restaurant breakfasts and conference room lunches, Frank Gehry and I talked about the family he was born into and the family that he created, who he wanted to be and who he became, what architects do generally, and what he does specifically. Most importantly, we talked about the influences that have shaped his work. Most of our talks took place at the work table in his studio. At the far end of the table is usually a visual inventory of the work most on his mind that day. There could be a building model that he might be thinking about, a product prototype, maybe a stack of construction photographs from an ongoing development. At our very first visit, the table held a big white lamp. It was a big paper-like lamp, which would later be called the Cloud and manufactured. The next time I visited with him, there was a beautiful piece of wood that would encase this new lamp. Another time I went in and there was a gorgeous bracelet on the table, and that was the harbinger of the new Tiffany collection, which he did. So at Gehry's less cluttered end of the work table, which is where we worked, there was drawing paper nearby and a pen. For as Gehry remembers, he also draws. Our initial conversations about his childhood, for instance, were punctuated by breaks for him to draw things like the papier-mâché hobby horses his father made, the first Toronto neighborhood that he remembered, the first house he lived in as a child. His is a visual memory, and the best way to describe where he grew up, or a building he admires, or even a building he designed, would be to recreate it in a sketch and not verbally. Sketchbooks follow him everywhere, including onto the airplanes and into the hotel rooms that he constantly inhabits. Gehry's almost childlike as he draws. He kind of hunches over and concentrates intensely on something that he so clearly enjoys. He's basically shy, and he's a small man, so with large crowds, he often seems also uneasy as people rush to meet him. He's clearly most at home at Gehry Partners and their sprawling office complex, which is near the LA airport. In a cavernous one-time industrial space, dozens of architects, designers, model makers, and other staff, most of them quite young, work on projects in various stages of development all over the world, in Abu Dhabi and Paris, Panama and Brooklyn, Miami, and of course Los Angeles. Gehry Partners has moved a few times now, but the interior of Gehry's studio space seems to remain fairly constant. There are large, very large, cardboard armchairs that he designed decades ago. And then there's the paper-laden desk. The walls are covered with awards, souvenirs, and photographs of the architect with people like Cellist Yo-Yo Ma, artist Robert Rauschenberg, architect Philip Johnson, and hockey legend Frank Mahovlich. Gary was a big hockey player. Shelves overflow with objects that he has made or acquired. Vases, snow domes, building mock-ups. There are so many books in that office that they overflow not just from the bookcases, but from the stacks that are next to the bookcases, as you have to be very, very careful when you're in that office. Gary was born Frank Owen Goldberg on February 28, 1929 in Toronto. His father was raised in New York in Hell's Kitchen and was a boxer, a truck driver, and a salesman who also had an interest in drawing. His Polish-born mother was self-educated, returning to high school as an adult, and she was a violinist who introduced her son to both art and to music. Leah and Samuel Kaplan, his mother's parents, were extremely important to Gary as a child, and he spent a lot of time with them at their home, their hardware store, and their synagogue. His grandfather was a Talmudic scholar who taught him to be both curious and to ask questions. And the two of them would sit in the hardware store, and they would be like working up clocks or cutting glass or threading pipes and talk about the Talmud. You know, why is the sky blue? Why is today shorter than last week? His grandmother, in turn, had a wood stove, and he would often go with her to the neighborhood shop to look for leftover wood pieces for the stove. They'd take all these wood pieces into, and they'd put them in burlap bags. And then when they got home, his grandmother would fill the kitchen floor with these pieces of wood. They'd be in all kinds of shapes. And the two of them would just sit on the floor together, creating little cities and bridges and buildings. When Gary and I would talk about his choosing architecture as a profession, our conversations would generally lead back to those times with his grandmother. Years later, as an adult, he realized all of that play gave him license to continue play. That was very important, he told me several times, because, quote, when you start out in architecture or in any of the arts, the baby steps you take are scary. By the time you get there, you've been through a school system that tries to make everything rational, mathematical, and logical. And all of a sudden, you're confronted with something that's emotional and intuitive. You look for anchors, and my anchor was this memory of my grandmother. When his family moved to Los Angeles in 1947, the city's frontier, the frontier spirit soon kindled Gary's own. He often speaks of the visual chaos of Los Angeles at mid-century, a magical place teeming with experimentation and freedom. He told me once that had he stayed in Toronto, he would probably never have become an architect. Not only would he not have been accepted at the university's Toronto Architecture School, given his terrible test-taking abilities, but he also thought that the culture in Toronto would not have given him the sort of nurturing that he got from the California art scene. The sort of discussion that artists were having in Los Angeles, he says, quote, led to my own language and made it possible. That kind of discussion wasn't happening in Toronto, close quote. Now here's a little bit of our conversation from the book about that topic. Eisenberg, what sort of things did you learn from Los Angeles artists? Gary, for Kenny Price, Ed Moses, Ron Davis, and some of the others, the craft and the art were one. It was not two separate acts, and that intrigued me. I was hoping an architect could do that. Their work was more direct and in such contrast to what I was doing in architecture, which was so rigid. You have to deal with safety issues, fireproofing, sprinklers, handrails for stairways, things like that. You go through training that teaches you to do things in a very careful way, following codes and budgets. But those constraints do not speak to aesthetics. So when I got close to those guys, I would hang out at their studios, I'd watch them work, and observe how they dealt with things. And it was very different. I was terribly enamored with the directness of it and the Mount Everestness of it. How they had to confront a white canvas. That whole process seemed so much more likely to produce beautiful work than the architectural process did. I knew pragmatic things had to be taken care of, and I could do that. But it wasn't enough. The way these artists thought and approached making things was a lot more intuitive and in touch with who they were. It seemed that was the way to find your voice, not the way I'd been doing it. So I started mimicking their process, which was hard to do with architecture. And of course, you can see where it led. Eisenberg, unlike the visual arts, architecture goes through so many hands that has to make a difference. Gary, building a building is like birthing the Queen Mary in a small slip at a marina. There are lots of wheels and turbines and thousands of people involved. The architect is the guy at the helm who has to visualize everything going on and organize it all in his head. Architecture is anticipating, working with and understanding all of the craftsmen, what they can do and what they cannot do, and making it all come together. I think of the final product as a dream image, and it's always elusive. You can have a sense of what the building should look like, and you can try to capture it, but you never quite do, close quote. Artists accepted him when fellow architects would not, and their influence is in everything he created, whether building or bracelet. Gary Associates said that constantly looking for paintings that he has referred to in their design discussions. The cover of the book, just to go back to the notion of art, is a sketch and a photograph of a building in Dusseldorf. And his inspirations for that building included both the 20th century bottle paintings of Giorgio Morandi and Bellini's Renaissance painting, Madonna with Child, between John the Baptist and Saint Elizabeth. Art actually seems to be where he turns in difficult times as well. At one point in our conversations, while he was talking about a particularly difficult design process, I asked him quite simply how he managed to keep inspiration going at times like that. And here's his reply. Gary, I tell my students when you're stuck, go to a museum. I do it myself. I'll go to a museum, I'll look at a painting, and it always uncorks me. I'll always try to find something in the painting. I do it with literature, too, and with music. Concerts make me explode with ideas. It's uncontrollable. Sometimes I can't even focus on the music, I get so carried away. But the best trigger for me is going to the museum. Eisenberg, given the design of your buildings, does sculpture have a particular attraction for you? Gary, yes, but painting more. Sculpture is more definite. Painting is more ephemeral, so you can read more into it. You're freer to interpret from paintings than you are from 3D object. You can fantasize more. It's not that the images you're looking at are translatable into a building. It is the fact that the images are so beautiful. They are so filled with ideas, close quote. Ideas also come from the client, of course. And you can consider, for instance, the sketch that was on the invitation that you got for today's talk. That's a sketch of the IAC Interactive Corporation building in New York, in Chelsea. And Chairman Barry Diller, for whom Gary built this building in New York, told me that he and Gary chatted about the building's location. They talked about how it was right across the street from the Hudson River and about how they both liked to sail. Diller said he was amazed at how much the finished building looks like that sketch. And those of you who have seen the building would surely agree with him. Now, actually, one of my favorite anecdotes working on this book was about that building, which was Gary's reputation of being just a little prickly often precedes him into a boardroom. And Barry Diller had told the Times that he was expecting Gary to be, quote, expensive, difficult, and ornery. So I called Diller, and I asked him if that proved to be the case. And here's what he said, quote, he's not expensive. That reputation is totally undeserved. He's absolutely not difficult. Ornery? Yes. Nicely, wonderfully ornery. Now, that's the end of the Diller quote. Now remember, this is a guy who once gave a talk that was called, I'm Not Weird. And even his very great patron, Thomas Krenz, the former director of the Guggenheim Foundation, used to describe Gary as sort of like Peter Falk and Columbo, partial to rumpled clothes and a slightly distracted, seemingly self-effacing manner. But today, however, he is also a celebrity, an architectural superstar at a time when architecture itself is a superstar. Gary and his buildings are daily fodder for publications and online blogs, cited both favorably and unfavorably for his unconventional designs. Now, he can be upset by the constant media glare, but on the whole, he certainly seemed to me to have healthy attitudes about fame and celebrity, which is possibly because, like many prominent architects, he encountered them quite late in life. Now, lucky for me, Gary was also a smart voice. His is a smart voice, rich in memory, incident, and insight. Unlike people who rewrite history, particularly their own history, Gary is remarkably consistent. If he talks about a life experience today that he told me about in 1989, changes in his story are really minimal. There might be a fresh detail, maybe like a newly remembered anecdote, but the voice may be more certain and more confident. The ideas, however, haven't changed. Gary likes to talk about how Bach's Brandenburg Concertos layer and return to themes and to strains, and that revisiting of ideas is key to both his work and his life. The architect was interested in city planning in college, for instance, and had done several other design, big urban design projects before he got his really big assignments for Atlantic Yards in Brooklyn and for Grand Avenue in Los Angeles a few years ago. I want to quote him again, quote, "I plan buildings in context," says Gary. "I talk with people who will live or work in my buildings, and I walk the neighborhoods. The elements of my life fit into a context as well. I come back to things I care about again and again. Stuff doesn't just fall out of a tree, you know." Close quote. Now, Beethoven was known to write down musical ideas, which he called sketches. And if something didn't work in one piece, Beethoven used it in another. Well, so have other composers, and so does Gary. If something doesn't work in one place, it'll be back in another. Actually, if it works well in one place, it will still be back in another. The 14th century sculptor Klaus Sluter, for instance, and in particular, the 17th century painter John Vermeer, can be found lurking in many a Gary project. To conclude, let me hand Gary back the microphone. Eisenberg, do you have a favorite time when you're working on a building? Gary, yes. It's when I have the plans and the scale right for both the neighborhood and the project in block form, before I make the curved shapes, before I do anything. When I get to that point, I feel comfortable this is where we're going to go. And the next move is just to finish the detailing, the materials, and the character of the shapes. It's what I call being in the candy store, because it's the fun part. It's also the most scary part, because it's the unknown. I start sketching and trying things until all of a sudden, something emerges that becomes interesting and I sort of follow it. But it's intuitive, it's not preconceived. I don't have an exact plan of action and I always feel like I'm leaping off a cliff. Eisenberg, do you feel like you're taking your collaborators with you? Gary, I collaborate with people on projects because it enriches the mix and gets you somewhere else you wouldn't have gotten to otherwise. When it's really working, it is like holding hands and jumping off a cliff together. Eisenberg, do you think perfection is possible? Gary, at the University of Southern California, where I went to school, they had cut in stone above the door a quote from Michelangelo, which said, quote, "A work of art is but a shadow of the divine perfection," close quote. I like that because it got me off the hook.